Shep, and I'm the internet director for Green Festivals. This is our fourth annual Green Festival. We're looking to top 30,000 people over this weekend. First ever. How many been here? This is your first time at Green Festival. All right, a lot of new people. Excellent. And I take it all the rest of you have been here. How many have been here all 4 years? Anybody? All right. We've got a following. Excellent. So we got commercials on WB20 for the first time this year. So this is reaching out much beyond the green sphere into the mainstream. So that's really our goal, is to take the green stuff out to everybody, the whole nation. So appreciate y'all coming here. So today, it's my honor to introduce Jim Fournier. He is an experienced software developer, industrial ecologist, entrepreneur. He's also the co-founder of Planet Work, which does monthly meetings here in San Francisco, Seattle, New York, and many other cities, bringing together technologists, people in the environmental movement, really trying to get more synergy amongst all the different systems out there. So today he's going to talk about the shift point. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jim Fournier.
Thank you, Joey. For anybody who hasn't already visited it, across the way here, there's a set of booths, a number of different exhibitors that are using information technology to work on ecology and social justice and progressive causes. Today, I'm not really going to talk much about what Planet Work usually focuses on. This talk is a sort of different view of the world that I've been working on for a long time. And it's really trying to take a big picture of what's going on and frame things in a way that we may not be used to. Very often, we get caught in one of a number of frames that people seem to spend a lot of time on. And I've found that in a lot of my work, I kind of bridge between these different worlds. So one of them that I think is probably more likely where we're coming from here would be a sort of limits to growth model that looks at a lot of very real issues in the world and sees the problems, and is very frightened by them. Because if you look at the situation, it is daunting. And the first part of this talk is going to take us through some of that quickly in case anybody isn't sort of aware of it or sort of big categories of how to think about it. The other view, though, it tends to be a very optimistic view that feels that somehow technology is going to solve everything and save us. And I think most of us that come from this more limits to growth view would feel better about that if we felt the people that held the optimistic view were paying attention to the problems that we're focusing on, and that's part of the dichotomy. But I tend to take the view, this is a sort of paraphrasing of a quote from John Stuart Mill, that in most arguments, both sides are right in what they affirm and wrong in what they deny. So by the end of this, I hope to sort of present a worldview that may bridge beyond some of those divisions. So the first part is just looking at the global situation. And I'm going to break it down into a couple of pieces. There's a lot of problems out there, a lot of ways to think about it. This is a sort of list of five key areas that I would focus on, that I think that these represent a number of the big themes that are really important to pay attention to, and a lot of themes that may be vying for our attention may not be as important if we were looking back 100 years or 500 years from now, but that arguably a lot of what the sort of key drivers and what happens falls into one of these areas. And so I'm just going to go through them in order now. If you haven't already seen it, this is the graph of temperature versus CO2 level for the last 1,000 years. And it just takes off in spikes. We've basically gone from under 300 parts per million to almost 4. And it's headed to 5 to 7 if things go the way they're going. Almost nobody can see a way around it. Now, that's 1,000 years. This is actually 150,000, and you can go back about 400,000, and we're already at a high peak. So that spike that we're seeing is not part of the fluctuation that's been going on. It's starting from the highest level of where things have been and then jacking up. And the range has been really in the 200 to 300, not even to 300 parts per million. We're now at almost 4. So it's very serious. And I'm actually, by the end of this talk, going to give you some hope. This is something that I actually regard as hopeful. This is the idea of peak oil. We don't know exactly where the peak is, whether it's this year or in 10 years. The furthest claim floating around is about 30 years. And it's not like when we hit the peak, all of a sudden the oil's gone. But from this point, the real price is likely to go up. Unfortunately, what's most likely to happen is that the price will go up, and then there'll be more drilling and more conservation, and that will cut demand, and then the price will fall. And it will be in a kind of ugly sawtooth thing for the next few years, where the price fluctuates around and whips the hell out of people trying to do conservation, because every time you start to make progress, you get knocked with a price drop. This is kind of a Green Party view of it that's sort of with rather be right than happy. I mean, it sort of shows us as cavemen, you know, in 1830, and then there's this little blip of abundant fossil fuels, and then in 2150, we're back to being cavemen. And, you know, while I think most of us identify more strongly with a green view, there can be a sort of green view that almost wants to say, I told you so, more than find how we're going to get through this. This is actually a fairly optimistic thing. This is energy use per person. And what it shows is that globally, we've actually, just from the little bit of price influence that we had in the 70s, stabilized per capita energy use, maybe not in this country, but globally. It's just that because population is still growing, in absolute terms, the use is still growing. And that means that CO2 is still growing, even though we're starting to make efforts to try and cut it back. It's still going up. And all of the negotiations and discussion really has nothing to do with trying to stop the growth. It's like very incremental decrease in how fast it's growing. So most of what the discussion has been around is very discouraging to those of us that are looking around at what we're up against. This is just a graph of population, if you've never seen it in this form. Again, showing about 2,000 years, but just showing how it spikes. And this is zooming in on the near future. And what this is saying is that the optimistic estimates that may be pretty good show us going from about 6.5 billion up to maybe 8.5 at the bare minimum. Some of those graphs show us just continuing to go. Now, in the 70s, population was sort of the big deal that people woke up to. And one of the encouraging things is very soon after people woke up to in this country, the population in the U.S. suddenly stabilized much faster than anybody expected. And that may be happening in the world. There seems to be pretty optimistic information about what it looks like, but we really need to keep an eye on it because it drives everything else. You should remember that all the increase in CO2 is not because of, you know, we're getting more efficient, but as long as we keep having more people, we keep generating more. Whatever we do with population, it has to turn out to be a curve that looks something like this. It's called an S-curve. And the basic idea is that it's a curve that started out kind of flat, it gets very steep, and then eventually it stops growing and turns the other way and starts to level off. Does this sound okay? This is a thing that's been floating around in sustainability for a long time, and it sort of on one side has population and the other impact, and then it has affluence over technology. And what this says is that if you have a few people who are very rich, they have a big impact. If you have a lot of people that are very poor, they may have the same impact. But it also says that if you change the technology that they're using, they could have more or less impact. And so really the only way we can get through this is to develop a kind of technology that's going to reduce the impact of a very large number of people. And that means that neither the technology that we have in the poor world or the technology that we have in the rich world is going to do it. Everyone in the world needs to go to a completely different kind of technology than what we have, and we have to do it very fast. It's the only way we're going to deal with the situation. This is just a little thing showing that, by some counts, we're over one planet's worth of natural resources being used. A huge amount of what resources we do use becomes waste, but a lot of that is measuring the mass. We're still pretty inefficient, but not as bad as this number that people throw around. I'm going through this stuff very fast because I want to get to the good news, but I want to make sure everybody's kind of a little bit on the same page. One of the ways that people think about our impact is the ecological footprint, how much surface of the area of the Earth our actions translate into. And these calculations, I think, are kind of problematic for a couple reasons. They were developed to try and make everything one count, like a dollar is one unit. But the problem is they can almost mask some of the worst impacts while overemphasizing energy impact. And I'm actually a little more optimistic about energy, and we'll go there in a bit. So the four things that I would really point to are all the direct impact on the biosphere. So outright destruction, often collateral destruction of forests. The collapse of fisheries, as David pointed out, we've taken out 90% of the fish stocks. Most fish stocks peaked in the 70s, and they're now in decline, pretty much virtually all of them. Exhaustion of farmland. This is color-coded to how much nitrogen is being put on land to produce food. Most civilizations in the world have collapsed because their farming collapsed. It's really not even on our radar right now because we're just waking up to other things, but the issue of depletion of farmland is huge. It also puts pressure on virgin nature because people have to keep destroying more wildland in the effort to try and produce food. And finally, there is a fair amount of people talking about fresh water now. So those four things, forests, farmland, fish, and fresh water, the four Fs, I would say we should focus on ahead of a lot of the stuff that's getting a lot of our attention, certainly ahead of recycling, which doesn't even rate on the triage model. But really what is under all of these is the effect of biodiversity. The only thing we can't recover from is the loss of diversity in nature. This is the one measure that 500 years, even 100 years from now, they will judge us by. How much of nature makes it through our lifetime is how much we'll make it through. Because by the end of our lifetime, we will value it so highly that we will desperately preserve what's left. And so the measure of our performance, of whether we succeed or fail, is how we preserve life. And if things are allowed to go the way they're headed right now, we will lose half of the species of plants and animals on the planet in less than 100 years. And it could be a lot less than 100 years, which means that really the neck of the hourglass is not just our lifetime, it's the next decade or two. That our actions really fast are what matter the most. Now, that's, I think, what really matters most. This fifth thing is not actually, I think, on a par with the other four things that I've been pointing to, but I think it may be most important because I think it's the leverage point. We basically have created a society where we've hypnotized ourselves to a bunch of game rules. And these game rules are of our own creation, but we treat them as if, above all else, they're the one thing that couldn't possibly change. And I think it's important not to like rail against them or make different people bad for the roles they're playing in the game, but just to recognize that this is mutable. And potentially probably unstable on its own accord. And that those points of instability will feel very frightening, but they actually will be the opportunity to change things. So to begin with, our money system is debt-based. We borrow money into existence, which essentially creates a game of musical chairs that all players are afraid of losing at all times, no matter how much money they have. Second, it's faith-based. The money basically is based on our collective agreement that it has value. And that is very fragile. That literally can change overnight. We've seen it happen before. It's also becoming increasingly unfair, which is making it increasingly unstable. 98% of the wealth is held by less than 2% of the population. It's changing. It's getting worse very fast. Much of what we call trade is really a global casino. and whole regions of the world get punished by the system fairly routinely and get thrown into misery and crisis. But if when this happens, these are probably going to be the moments of greatest opportunity. So I point to this as really the most likely leverage point on the frightening trends that are in this list. So, you know, faced with all of that, it's very easy to go into some very dark views of it. And I'll just sort of complete this cycle because I think it's important not to shrink from looking at this, but I'm going to spend the rest of the time after this talking from a different perspective. So faced with this, it's a common metaphor that you'll hear thrown around where people say, well, humans are like cancer. It's a valid biological metaphor. Where else could you see a system where an organism just consumes everything in sight and just, you know, keeps going without any regard for what else is happening? Another example of that would be mold or bacteria in a petri dish, where it would just consume all of the food until the population crashes. And there are a lot of examples in nature of situations where a population will just overconsume until everything's gone and then crash. The only optimistic metaphor that I can find in biology where you have very, very rapid growth that goes somewhere is the metaphor of embryonic development. If you think about the global system as if it were an egg, as if the deposits of fossil fuel were more like the white of the egg, and all of what we're doing in growing industrial civilization is essentially some new structure that's trying to be born out of this, you could make some sense out of it. It's probably the only way that you could make some sense out of it. And if you start to think about that, there's tremendous arguments that a lot of what we're doing are creating new levels of complexity that were unimaginable. And they, in fact, seem something like the nervous system of some new entity that's very hard to get your mind around. The first person to talk about this was a man named Teilhard de Chardin, who talked about the noosphere, the idea that there's the biosphere and the lithosphere and the hydrosphere, and that this new layer that humanity is growing with our consciousness and our technology is like some sort of new organism. Now, the argument I just gave there is not new. This is still fairly fringe, but it's floating around. The problem with it is that it tends to be an argument more about consciousness, and there are sort of parallel arguments about evolution of consciousness and spiritual development that may at a certain level be inspiring, but they don't seem to address the hard nuts and bolts levels of energy and survival and technology that we all live embedded in and that money seems to be about. And so unless we can say something at that level, there doesn't seem to be much optimistic that we could say. So this next piece is really to take a different tack and just look back at the very long span of biological metaphors through evolution. So when life first appeared, it basically consumed what was available. Organisms came out of the primordial soup and ate the soup. And as far as we can tell, this continued pretty much the same way we're doing with fossil fuels until they'd eaten everything. Whereupon there was a crisis, and somewhat analogous to peak oil, and organisms developed photosynthesis. And with photosynthesis, life was all of a sudden able to harness sunlight. And so this then continued for a very long time with organisms harvesting sunlight and giving off oxygen. And the oxygen released in the atmosphere didn't have any effect for a long time because the oxygen had to rust all of the iron that was in the rock. And this went on for a very long time until essentially everything was rusted and the oxygen level started to go up. And when this happened, we had an oxygen crisis that's pretty much analogous to the CO2 crisis we're having now, only worse. Because oxygen was actually toxic and poisonous to the organisms that existed there. And as far as we can tell, the level may have gotten so high that they would have started bursting into flame. So this is just to show that within the evolutionary record, there are crises similar to the ones we're facing now in terms of energy and atmosphere, and that life has a good track record of jumping to a higher level of order and getting out of them. What life did then is it looked at the oxygen and said, this is a big source of energy, we'll use it, and evolved organisms that could breathe air, could breathe oxygen. And with both photosynthesis and respiration in place, the carbon cycle resulted. And pretty much all of the life forms we know have evolved with the carbon cycle in place, so that there was a balance between plants and animals and the atmosphere and oxygen and carbon dioxide being traded. And the carbon cycle has continued basically until the dawn of human agriculture. We seem to be able to detect it beginning to go out of balance, not with fire, but with when we started cutting down trees and growing crops. And this got accelerated tremendously once we started burning fossil fuels, which was basically plants that had harvested sunlight before and been fossilized. And so we've been using fossil fuel now and unbalancing the situation slowly, and that unbalance has been building up. And we get to the human time scale. And in the human time scale, things are different because for all of our experience as humans, nature is essentially an unchanging baseline. We aren't wired to be able to understand that we would have an effect on nature. Nature has an effect on us. And yet we set in motion a change in time where how much change happens in an increment of time starts taking off. And it starts accelerating, and for most of the time that this acceleration happens, after we begin to notice, first we call it history, and then we call it progress. And it's really only very recently that some of us have begun to look at it, and rather than seeing progress, this accelerating change, as something optimistic, it starts looking like something frightening. And the fear is that this thing is sort of taking off and we start noticing the possibility that it could crash. And it starts feeling a little dizzying, like where is it going and how fast are we eating up the world and are we cancer? Are we a mold in a petri dish? And we're suddenly in a single generation faced with a new situation. And in many ways, what's remarkable is not that there are people who don't get this. What's remarkable is that there are people who do. In a single generation, in a single few decades, we've had to take on board that nature has gone from something that's frightening and potentially dangerous to us to something that we could damage. And this is a huge transformation in our evolution. The magnitude of this change is not to be underestimated. But what those of us that are taking on the frightening part of it also are not now seeing is that if we're going to pull it off, we're also at a fold point, and it's in fact possible for a lot of these trends to stabilize. And I don't think it's possible for any of them to reverse direction, and there's a big difference. Many people look at what's going on and say, my God, we've taken a wrong turn, we have to make a U-turn, we have to go backwards. And I think this doesn't sell for very good reasons, and it's not true. The only way out is to go forward. But going forward under business as usual also won't work. We're at this unique moment where what we have to do is the curve has to change direction. That we kind of came out of a stable plateau and the thing started accelerating. And we need to use that very rapid acceleration to go where we need to go. And then as it starts to become more stable, decelerate towards a new stable plateau. And the idea that there could be somewhere where we're going has not been part of the mythos of modernity. The mythos of modernity is that the acceleration goes on forever. And in fact, it's almost impossible to find anybody that can even imagine that it wouldn't. Especially in the technologists and the technology will save us camp. So this is a sort of doubly heretical statement. One is that technology will save us, but also that technology will actually slow down and go someplace stable. So a couple of things to notice about that point of inflection in the curve. At that point where the curve changes, where things are changing very fast, it's changing so fast that you wouldn't want to keep anything. A very little increment of time out in the future, you'd be so much closer to the stable plateau that everything you did now you wouldn't keep around because it was so inefficient that you wouldn't want it around. So things are necessarily unsustainable at this point, but it doesn't mean that it's not tremendously important that our consciousness change towards sustainability. It's also only at this moment that we can first time begin to glimpse where we might be going. Up until this point of the change, you couldn't see past it. It's like Y2K was this mirror that you couldn't see beyond. And only once you crash through it, you begin to go, wait a minute, we're in the future, what happens now? This moment also is in some way analogous to kind of a birth canal, that there's a sort of holographic complexity to the whole thing, where all different levels of meaning and metaphor are all present at once and all inform what's going on, and that is frightening, chaotic, and highly unstable by its very nature. In every birth, there's the possibility of death, and not just at some abstract physical level, at a material level. So with this sort of large abstract frame, what could we point to that would actually show us what's going on and that would put some concrete understanding to what this means materially, not just metaphysically or spiritually? So the first example that I think shows this fairly concretely is just to look at the trend of what's been happening by itself in fuels over time, in what humanity uses for energy. This is showing some of these curves. The blue one and the gray one are S-curves, and the red one is a bell curve. And what's been happening is we've moved from wood to peat to coal to oil to natural gas. And since the 2000, all of a sudden, even George Bush says we're going to a hydrogen economy. If you were paying attention to it, prior to 2000, almost nobody would say the word hydrogen outside of very few fringe people. Now everybody knows it. Nobody noticed when it switched. What's important about this is that each time you move down this stack, you move basically from carbon to hydrogen. Each one of these fuels has less carbon and more hydrogen until when you get to hydrogen, there is nowhere else to go. You've arrived at the end of the converging line. What's important about this is it illustrates that in matter, there are these critical fold points. There are these points of transformation that are absolutely fundamental. And they are part of what's going on, and they are part of this big picture of transformation that is not arbitrary and has never happened before and probably won't happen again for a very long time, if ever, in matter. Now, in order to try and explain what's going on in matter, I'm going to take you through chemistry. This is a picture of all the chemical elements arranged as a continuous spiral. This is what's called the major groups, and it shows you more about the coherence of chemistry. It's the four columns of the periodic table. And this is just the first two rows of the major groups. And pretty much all of biological activity takes place just with the chemicals in this little spiral, and mostly with the ones in the first row of it. And so if you look at the very center of it, the white dot with an H is hydrogen. It's the smallest, lightest element. And it's the core of energy and life. And it shows you why, when you converge there for energy, there's nowhere else to go. It's not like you're going to invent some other chemistry somewhere and you can do it a different way. The green dot right below it is carbon. The purple dots opposite going upwards are the noble gases. They're completely full, so they don't react with anything. And so carbon and silicon opposite them are half empty, so they react with everything. They're the building blocks of life and rock, respectively. They are the only elements that can be in that role because of how they fit together, how the puzzle works. And what I'm trying to do with this is just to convey a sort of very simple way of grokking things that most of our culture doesn't take on board because it's made very complex, or complicated. Underneath that, there can be some very simple pictures of what's going on that can give you tremendous insight into why things are as the way they are. The two dots right to one side of carbon with the N and the O are nitrogen and oxygen. Those four elements, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, constitute almost all of organic life. These are the elements that are traded back and forth between life as the currency of all that happens. and they're right at the core of matter. And there's a reason why they're in that position. And as we begin to recognize that we need to operate at the same level of elegance that nature does, it's going to be in this kind of realm that we have to look and understand things. So if we think about photovoltaics made out of silicon, remember that silicon was right under carbon. So nature harnesses sunlight with carbon. It builds photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is about 1% efficient. When we arrange silicon into photovoltaic panels, they're about 10% efficient. They're an order of magnitude more efficient than what nature was able to do in converting sunlight to energy. This is a sign that, in a sense, photovoltaics with silicon are like an octave of what nature did with carbon, with photosynthesis. It's an equivalent breakthrough to what nature did 3 billion years ago when it developed photosynthesis. It's a fundamental way of arranging matter that allows energy to be transformed. Nature has continued to reuse that same insight ever since then. It made one major advancement into a second kind of photosynthesis, but basically these insights about how the puzzle is put together are absolutely fundamental, and once achieved, get reused over vast periods of time by nature. It would seem plausible that we're in the same position. We are at this point of transition that is as fundamental as those transitions that were made by nature at each of those breakpoints that I've shown you, where energy and atmosphere came to crisis in the history of biological evolution. And life always solved the problem. So, on the other hand, all I'm doing here is explaining why photovoltaics are good. We're told by economists right now that we can't get there fast enough, and they're probably right. That what we're up against right now in dealing with global warming, in dealing with the number of quads of energy that humanity is using right now, versus how fast we can build out solar and wind, there's a gap. Because not only do we have to get to huge amounts of energy very quickly, we also need to effectively not only stop but reverse global warming. And until now, I've been very kind of depressed about that. I'm just going to take you through one more little thing. This is a diagram that shows how solar works. It's not just about energy, it's about the difference between very organized energy and very disorganized heat. And it's that little spread between the order and the disorder that both solar, wind, and biomass all use. All of our renewable energy is really solar. Even our fossil fuels are solar in an old form. So the only place where there's really enough energy floating around right now to deal with the situation while we build out solar is going to be in biomass. But all of the approaches to biomass that we've had so far would deplete soils even faster. And depleting the soil is already a huge problem. We also need something that will not just recycle carbon as it goes around the loop, but will actually remove net carbon from the atmosphere. Because we've already put so much carbon into the atmosphere, and we're going to put so much more with the permafrost breaking loose, that we're actually going to need to be able to go back the other way. And over the last couple of years, I've stumbled on a technology, and by full disclosure, sort of fate has led me to be involved in developing the company, that creates a loop. This is a diagram not really of a machine so much as a set of processes that let us take biomass, make hydrogen energy from it, from which we can make biodiesel, and then take some nitrogen out of the air, and with that scrub CO2 out of existing coal and oil-fired power plants, and make a fertilizer that actually restores the soil and puts all the mineral nutrients that were in the biomass and even in the coal back in the soil so that you can make tropical soils that were previously unfertile more fertile, increase the amount of both food and fuel that you can grow on those soils without having to go after more fresh natural landscape, and actually remove net carbon in the process. Most of the real work is done by mycorrhizal fungi. It turns out that mycorrhizal fungi are the sort of the last mile between plant roots and nutrients. and they have these very tiny filaments that reach out and gather water and nutrients for the plants. And to protect themselves, they exude a kind of a glue that glues together whatever's around them into a little sheath. And that includes particles of organic matter that would have otherwise gone back in the air. So once you put this kind of fertilizer in the ground, you set off a virtuous cycle where the little charcoal particles have nutrients that are sucked into them by electrostatic charge, and then the mycorrhizal fungi reach in and draw them back out and deliver them to the plants. And in the course of doing that, the fungi glue carbon together and build soil. They create something called aggregates that give soil its tilth. So this represents essentially one of the kind of miracles I've been looking for that would let us do a bridge to get from where we are now to where we have to go while we build out solar and wind. And in the long run, it probably will be solar that ends up being much of our energy supply. But this represents the kind of bridge that would let us undo the Gordian knot. Because just as the way we deal with problems right now seem to be kind of like a Gordian knot, where every time you pull on the problem one way, you make something else worse, this becomes more like all of a sudden jumping to a sort of systemic solution that's more like a winning hand of a game of solitaire, where every time you pull one card off, you expose something else, and then you fix that. So we can free the petrochemical fertilizer industry from its addiction to natural gas, because right now, every time we make ammonia, we make just as much CO2. So now, all of a sudden, we're making fertilizer from the same plants that they're selling the fertilizer to their customers. And then we're cleaning up coal. In the long run, it may be cheaper to make the energy just from biomass, and we'll give up on coal, but for the time being, we can clean up coal. We can also clean up the sulfur and nitrogen coming out of coal, which stops the acid rain. When we stop using nitrate fertilizers, we stop flushing nitrogen into the water that's acidifying the ocean, which is also a source of global warming. We can do this in small scale for biomass for poor farmers, freeing them from the need to buy fertilizer and even imported oil, so that those farmers can suddenly restore their soil while selling energy. So it creates the possibility of going forward to restorative technologies at a really large scale. This is an example of things that I see happening in different little pieces all over, but the sort of picture of what all of this stuff looks like taken to really a huge scale, by and large, isn't out there in the mainstream. What this really amounts to is human energy technology becoming like part of the carbon cycle in nature, the carbon and nitrogen cycle, where those smallest, simplest elements are being cycled around by human technology the same way nature has been cycling them around. And we're extracting energy from the loop and extracting food crops from the loop, but the amount we're taking out is really small in these big flows that we're creating. This is an example of something that's been around for a while that's called industrial ecology. There, the idea is that different kinds of technological processes would be linked together so that the outputs from one are the inputs to another. A simple example of that was the work that first John Todd did with cleaning up wastes using different parts of nature, but that was still a pretty simple thing of a one-way throughput. This idea has been maybe most elegantly phrased so far by Janine Benyes, who's coined the term biomimicry. And the idea with biomimicry is that we're copying nature. We're looking into nature for solutions that we can then copy and implement. But I want to suggest that what I'm talking about is really beyond that, and that what I'm talking about I call meta-nature. And the sort of intuition that it's possible came to me about 20 years ago when I discovered this. This is an extension of Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, only where he has the square and the circle in the golden mean relationship. This also has the triangle and the pentagram. So this links together the three simplest shapes in plane geometry and kind of a puzzle, where all you do is take the golden mean and these shapes and put them together, and out pops human anatomy and the chakras and the skeletal system to a fairly high degree of definition. And the three numbers represented, the triangle, the square, and the pentagon, represent 3, 4, and 5, which are the Pythagorean numbers. And this little diagram appeared at 3:45 a.m. And what it gave me the faith to go looking for is the idea that built into the puzzle of matter and geometry and form and us are all the solutions we need to pull off the problem, to find the solutions to the problem. And that if we look with the sort of faith and expectation that what we need is in fact there, that the designs are not something we invent out of our cleverness, they're something we discover that are already built into the blueprint of creation. So out of this whole thing, this is kind of my underlying thesis statement, that there really is a potential state that would be like an octave of nature, and that this octave of nature is something that's built into the potential of matter just as much as nature is, and that we're essentially at the halfway point in kind of a lunge to get there. And that what we've called history up to this point has been the sort of blind part of that lunge. And the point of inflection in the curve is characterized by many things, including the awareness that it's possible to go there. And so that at the point that we wake up to this possibility and recognize ourselves and situate ourselves, we can go from being terrified and blaming people for what's happened up to this point to recognizing that it's all part of one process that can only unfold this way, and that we're doing exactly the way we have to do it. But once we have this recognition, we need to go forward. We need to recognize what we're doing. And it's only out of that recognition, I'm going through these fast, but I need to get where I'm going. Let me skip that one. That we can at once validate what everybody's done up to this point, and in light of that new recognition, explain to them why, in the light of this new understanding, they have to change their trajectory, in many cases only slightly, to take us where we actually need to go. So that we are at once coming from a place of absolutely complete transformation of the system and validation of everything that's happened up to this point, and in many cases, fairly minor adjustment of what each player finds they have to do. So I've skipped through a bunch of slides because we're about out of time, and I wanted to get to this last one. I'm going to actually shift back to one that I skipped over. Well, this is to say that there are two things that we're left with doing. One is building out this transformative technology fast enough, which the free market may very well do. And the other is preserving nature long enough that it's not accidentally destroyed while the programming gets changed. And so this really tells us that in terms of philanthropy and in terms of our civil actions, the most important thing that it falls to do is to preserve nature long enough to get there. That we are essentially all as Noah, and we need to know that. And that is really our calling in this lifetime. But that the ark is the transformative technology. And when we build that technology, we will preserve both nature and go to a quality of life that all of humanity would actually enjoy and want to live. And this is actually where we're headed. Thank you.